Ready? All right.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Fisher, any remarks to kick off before we do a roll call and, yeah, hello? Michael?
Thank you, Robert. I have a colleague, Noelle. She's the main presenter. I think she's going to take us through roll call and then has any of the background documents you may wish to take us through.
Sounds good. I have our roll call list on the screen. Is that visible for you guys?
Almost.
A little bit more?
Are we okay. We can do it this time. Okay.
So that for the record.
Thank you. For the record. And then I guess Bernice, just to point of information, do we want to, just because of meeting being recorded, anyone from the public that is attended, attend any comments? I think we just want to know who they are. Okay. So we can skip that portion, and Robert, I just wanted to defer to you too, in terms of the meeting, you know, if you want to start the actions for the purpose.
Yeah, if we could pull the actions up on the screen and kind of review them for those that are here that might not have been part of the last meeting, kind of go through that. It'd be nice to get that a little bit larger on the screen, or I'll just turn around and read this one.
That's okay.
How's this?
If you can you X out the participant list, maybe that'll make it bigger.
And then
would that be on my end?
Hi.
Okay. Well, if you can just kind of walk through those that have any comments and any actions that we want to add on there.
Robert, it might be helpful to you just to kind of give everyone the background that there's been, you know, two meetings so far and there's been a lot of discussions and we've identified some top level actions to pursue, you know, this early stage. I mean, you've had some presenters speak at these subcommittee meetings. You welcome the APA to come, and we've tracked their kind of state policy actions that they're tracking. We have them preliminarily as this list, haven't formally included them in this process, but we are tracking that.
I think for the most part, we just have a couple of questions.
I would just characterize this a little differently. That is, we can put down some topics presented by different topics.
Right.
But we haven't really vetted even the discussions inside of how to prioritize. In fact, our poll will necessarily be prioritized to make some focus in.
The more the priority objectives rather than action items as far as the end. Is Mr. Rovito on today, this afternoon, or?
Mr. Chairman, both Michael Rovito and Chris Lankvist are on today.
Excellent. And at some point during the meeting, would you be prepared to speak to the findings that the utilities reported to you?
I'd probably speak to them at a high level. We got some views as quick as we could, but we could kind of summarize a little bit about what they're saying to us, yeah.
Okay, because I have the email that you sent that we could share later on in this meeting. That was something you'd be prepared to speak to.
So, can I interrupt? I apologize. We're getting some messages in the chat that they cannot hear people talking, so can you make sure you're turning on your microphones and speaking in the microphones? Thank you.
Turn the microphone
Here we go. All right. That should solve that. Thank you.
Guilty as charged. Sorry.
So if we think of it as we kind of scroll down the policy objectives, and I'd welcome AP to comment on their own recommendations if they want to speak to that.
Robert, this is Mike Rivita. Did you want me to speak on what's on the screen or what we sent?
Yeah. No, on the screen right now, just kind of give the members here present an opportunity to understand what those priorities represent and what action items might be brought forward from them.
Yeah, thanks. So this is Michael Rivita, Deputy Director at Alaska Power Association. Our policy positions are put together each year through a combination of our managers forum providing input, our government affairs committee then taking that input and putting them into policies, kind of like what you see on the screen here, and then our board of directors, which is made up of our active electric utility members, votes to approve those for the following year or suggest changes to them before they'll approve them. So what you see from APA in terms of our state, and also federal policy positions as well, I know we're focusing on the state here, is a summation of issues and policy positions that our membership supports throughout the state. And some of them are statewide, some of them are regional, but generally our membership supports each other as they go through with these. And when we look at these, a lot of the policy positions come from the operational experiences of our electric utility members who, and specifically from the managers forum, of which Mr. Rizzo is co-chair of along with Bill Stam from Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. And these are, a lot of them are developed because of challenges or big opportunities that our electric utility members see, and then we turn those into items that we hope will garner attention and have action in the state legislature or with the administration. So that's kind of the process, Robert. I don't know if you want me to go through them. I can only see one at a time because it's very small on our screen here remotely.
So if we could just scroll to the first one, and then Mr. Rivita, if you want to just kind of speak quickly to that would be appreciated for context.
I'll go kind of quickly through them and try to be as succinct as possible. And some of these don't seem to, we have our 2023 state policy positions, and some of these I've seen on the screen are not included in those. I think they might have come from what I said the other day to the committee. But generally, our membership supports streamlining the permitting process, and they look at this in the context of what it takes to put together a project, and especially with the current status of supply chain, supply issues, workforce issues, and some of the time frames on the funding that comes with federal grants or loans or just interest rates moving, that if the permitting regime to approve these projects or any part of the project takes longer than those other elements can provide for it, it makes it very difficult to construct the project or to move forward. And that's probably something that individual utilities could answer better than we could at APA, because they deal in the minutiae of these permits every day with their projects.
And we'll get that into a little more specificity, I think, when we get to the letter you sent, and then with Chairman Kerber here. So
I was just going to say, I was given a contact, and so we should put on this as an action. I need to follow up with that contact for the one utility that had a specific permitting problem that they offered up to get some details so we could put context around it and understand what the potential remedy might be. So
was that the King Cove?
No.
Or was that
it? It was.
The utility that Mr. Hanneman is referring to, the Copper Valley Electric Association, I connected Mr. Hanneman and Travis Millian with each other to talk more about that example I brought up in the last subcommittee meeting.
Thank you. All right, so the next one?
The state funding with local match for federal grant cost share, this is something that I brought up in a previous meeting where there's concern amongst our membership that if they do, in fact, become chosen or receive federal grants, that the cost share might be either challenging or almost insurmountable. And there's concern amongst our members at various levels and at various degrees of what that could mean. And, of course, they want to go for this federal money as best they can because it would be imprudent to not go for federal grant opportunities. But then there is the other aspect of how do they come up with a match. And this is something that APA has spoken with the Department of Energy on a number of times, including during our flying to Washington, D.C. back in June with a number of our members. But I think some of the, on the federal side, they're kind of hamstrung by what the law says must take place or what certain policies say. So this is one where I think our members might be looking toward the states if there's a mechanism to help with that cost share element, and not only for the feasibility of it, but also to keep the cost lower, low, as low as possible on ratepayers and consumers who, in the end, under Alaska's general structure of electric utilities are paying and funding these projects.
Okay. And so, I don't know if the policy there, just kind of, identify that as a potential policy issue to raise, not just because of the funds that have to be raised for the match, but sometimes with the funds that are raised for match is debt, which then is carried in the past on the ratepayers. So it's definitely something to...
And generally, do we know, this is Carl Hanneman, do we know, I mean, the range of percentage of the match is irrelevant here in the current...
I think also 20%.
20%.
But it could vary a lot.
So I know it varies a lot. There. Is it?
Yeah, we tend to be about 15 to 20%.
Okay.
Okay. Every through the infrastructure and the IRA, everyone's a little bit different, but we said 15% will probably.
But it's not 50 generally.
Generally not. There is actually the GRIP applications, which was briefed on. They are 50% match, but that's also for a much larger sum of money. That's $250 million minimum ask, and they just wanted to obviously have a 50% match. But most of them like that, like the vehicles, things like that, is at 15%.
And then the next objective on the list?
Yeah, this is Michael Rubito again from APA for the record. We talked about this a little bit, I think, Tony Uzo also mentioned it at the last subcommittee meeting. There's concern amongst our members of the state PUC not allowing or moving to not allow transmission and distribution lines to share the DOC right away, which would be a significant cost increase on electric utilities. And, to date, our electric utility members have typically shared that right away, and it's a lot less expensive to the ratepayers because in that case, the utility is not having to go out and acquire private property or other properties to create their own right-of-way, so to speak. And so our ask, and we've asked this to DOT, we pushed for this and urged the state to continue allowing these distribution and transmission lines to share that right-of-way because of the cost impact of not being allowed to share the right-of-way. And I think our members are good partners with DOT, and I know that they work hard to coordinate with DOT on construction projects and other intricacies of sharing that right away. But if this committee can recommend one thing, we hope to recommend a lot of things, but one of the things that we recommend is to continue allowing those lines to share that DOT right away just for the ease of that situation and for the ratepayer's sake.
Thank you.
Do we understand that the primary conflict or objectives are along major highways, primary roads, secondary roads? What Generally, is it, I mean, all of the above?
My staff would say it's plus D, it's all of the above.
Yeah.
Yes, 20 years old for the record. What we're experiencing is on any state road, and you have to realize that for statute, utilities really anywhere in the U.S. have the right to be in that corridor. That's what the corridor is for. What we have seen is, in recent years, is a real push. I mean, the state even or DOT hired to put out an RFP for a consultant. I think it was a $150,000 contract to look at this specific issue and find ways to in my view, push utilities out of the right of way. You have to realize what that does, because where else are you going to go? You're now talking to individual property owners, of which there are numerous. So it puts the ability to, you know, even provide these kinds of service at risk ultimately in the future as you have to expand and replace. And I think from DOT's perspective, they view this as a growing cost of projects, which I think is understandable, a concern. We've seen materials, transformers go up 380%. But I would point out that, you know, even a cursory review shows that it's the federal government that pays for like 92% of those utility relocations. So
you mean if you have pre-existing electrical distribution or transmission facilities in a right-of-way and DOT wants to expand their road footprint, they have to move your stuff.
They have to move it.
And
it's a significant cost. And what we're seeing at this point looks like a direction where they're headed towards never providing a formal permit, so that the utility would always then
have the burden
of relocating whenever the highway needed to move, have something moved out of the way.
Right.
So it's a pretty unusual situation. I mean, we're a state that sees a higher reimbursement from the federal government than certainly I experienced in New Jersey, where it's almost inverse.
And so Tony, on that, if DOT has to then acquire adjacent right away from private landowners by essentially doing what you might otherwise have to do.
Well, that's a core competence for the DOT. I mean, they have people.
Right away people. Right?
Yes.
But essentially they would have to do it, and then it would become a project cost that is potentially reimbursable by the feds.
Yeah, and again, Tony's right on the record, but yeah, so imagine widening a highway in Wasilla. Are you gonna, it isn't just the members or the utility ratepayers along that route that use that road.
Right.
But yeah, they would be, along with other ratepayers, burdened to, you know, bear that uncertainty and cost associated with relocations from a place that's the place that we're designated to be. And it's now become an uncertainty. And uncertainty is the, you know, enemy of a lot of things, not only energy security, but in terms of the stability of rate and our ability to execute on projects.
That's fair.
Yeah, just for a credit to AEA, just a point of clarification, I just want to, for everybody listening, and that is with these right-of-ways, it's not just electrical. It's telecommunications, it's water, it's sewer, it's affecting everybody's rates. And so I just want to clarify, this is a policy or regulation change from DOT. This is not a statute, I know that, but is it when did this pain start to morph, if you might have those two?
Yes, Tony, as I would defer to APA, Michael and Crystal, they've been tracking this since it is really a, you know, not just the electric utilities, but as the electric trade organization for the state, that, you know, this isn't just a Madison Electric or it's a statewide issue with DOT that the electrics have referred to. So I would defer to them. I know it's been a number of years.
That's what it seems like. It's a policy or a directional judgment leadership issue, not necessarily a regulation or statute issue. But not that we can't get a hold of it and write them in, but
some of it is just inherited. There are times where DNR has gone in for mining or logging roads, and those roads have been upgraded and then used for general community use, and then they've been adopted as public right-of-ways without the road plots. So we saw that on Prince Wales Island, building up that inner tie. There was some hurdles that should have been already right at that cost the ratepayers had to bear.
Yeah, I'm not a member of the committee, but I would like to point out that it's not just DOT, but other areas that we need to get to yes on. And I think we need to focus on for the lower the cost of power and get to yes. But a suggestion would be is that instead of characterizing what DOT does or does not think, my suggestion would be is to have either Ryan Anderson, the commissioner, or one of his designees kind of come forward and explain this policy rather than speculating as to the who, what, where, and why of their position. Thank you.
So we could put perhaps a little sense of that in the, I think it's not just DOT, but DNR also has roads. Whatever state agencies have access to that. Before we do a wrap on this, I'm just going to make sure, I emailed you and attached this with just as we started. Is that something that we can throw up the letter from the APA? Do I have your computer that has all your emails on it?
Pull it up for you, yeah. It's
Mr. Review, do you have anything else on this list? Is there another bullet point below that from the priorities before we get into the letter you sent?
Well, this is Michael Review, the last power substation. I mean, there's a few more things on the list. You have to come on the ones on the screen. I should go through those or just wait on these and go for the letter?
How do we want to do it? So we're going to pull the letter up, but please let's scroll down. If you could just scroll down and at least get the highlights pointed out there. We'll just quickly go through the next couple of bullets. I think there's only one or two left, right?
Yeah, apologies. These tabs are a little large, so it's hard to see them at the magnified view. But this is the last one.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Rita, just want to speak to that briefly, then we'll pull up the letter.
Sure. The last one that's on the screen here, you want me to speak to that?
Sure.
Yes, all right. So this is Mike Rita, last power association. Yeah, this one is kind of a perennial policy division for us with the power cost equalization program and the endowment. And I know that, you know, the Alaska Energy Security Task Force has heard a lot about PCE, and you all understand, I believe, what it is and what it does, but our big policy is that the program and especially the endowment be maintained for statutory purposes, largely because of the certainty that it provides to PCE communities, of which APA membership is actually only a fraction of the number of PCE communities that there are. But, you know, this, we go with this policy position each year because we don't want the endowment to be used for something that's not statutorily approved already in statute, and there's a number of items that it can be used for. But essentially, if our PCE receiving electric utility members continue innovating in their own right and working to bring down costs, we want that program to be there and funded in full so that the folks out there can still have that benefit.
Thank you. Can we pull the letter that was received from the Power Association, and just to be different, there's some methods of madness. I just start at the bottom of the letter and work backwards so we end up on a regulatory issue, then we'll go to Chairman Kerber to talk more from that perspective.
And you know, this is Michael. I just forwarded you that email, so it should be in your inbox to pull up.
There you go. And thank you. We appreciate this. There's a fair bit of work that went into this. We just asked. We told in the last meeting. And then reached right out to the utilities to receive input so it's not exhaustive. These are just the points that was exhausting there at the top of their mind. So, Mr. Rivito, if you would kind of start at the bottom, if you would, please, and move up the list so that we end on a discussion with the regulatory, and that way Mr. Kerber can respond and we can continue the conversation from there. If you would, please.
Yeah, thanks. So This is Michael Rivita again, Alaska Power Association. I want to preface what I wanted to say, that we put this together in a fairly quick manner, and so we kind of, our typical process of using APA and embedding it through our board was not able to be done because of the, you know, quick nature of the turnaround. So I can speak to a high level on some of the stuff, not everything I'm expert on, especially in the regulatory section, but what we did is we went out to our membership for feedback on what they're seeing within the confines of what we were asked by this committee to look at, and then this is what we got back, and we kind of polished it up a little bit to make sure that it fit within what the committee was looking for. And so I cannot pretend to be an expert on every single thing in here, but I will give the highlights, and then anything I can't talk about deeply, I will admit to that. I can try to find you if there's someone better to do it at a future meeting, perhaps. But so the bottom, when I started at the bottom, was some feedback we got from our membership about the RCA reviewing and approving energy supply contracts. And Robert, I'm sorry, I'm not an expert on this section here. This is just feedback that we received from some members, and basically that they had thought that required the RCA approving energy supply contracts between electric utilities and non-regulated vendors like IPPs or gas companies or somebody else was a burden on them. And I think I'll just leave it there, but I don't want to say too much because I'm not an expert in this section.
Just quickly, apologies for a moment, Mr. Kerr.
So, Keith Kerr, for the record. Yeah, is this the email you were talking about just a moment ago you just got from Lugo?
Yes.
Yeah, and so I really don't have any comment on this at this point other than I'll go back and talk. I know that from one of my colleagues who's a long-serving member, there was a period of time when the commission was not approving any gas supply contracts in the early part, the latter part of the first decade of the century. And so I want to talk to them about that, but perhaps, do you have any situation related to this issue you might want to add on to? Because I'm not thinking that in my couple of years that I've approved gas, the energy supply contracts with utilities. So would you like to speak to that, Tony?
Yeah, Tony, for the record, I was not directly involved with submitting this comment and didn't come from my utility, but I'm familiar with it. I think from a high altitude, taking a high altitude look at this might be the best place to start. Many jurisdictions, two other states that I work in, fuel supply contracts were not required to be approved by regulatory or public utility commissions, the equivalent of the RCA. They were not. In fact, they were in retrospective. We as a utility would obtain our fuel or our natural gas from, from producers off of an interstate transmission system. It would go into rates, and then there would be kind of a look back on a quarterly basis just to, test the math. The commission was keeping the utility honest. There is something to be said on the other side of this, though. One of the pros, and it was NSTAR, I believe, historically, that started this in the state. And if you're an investor-owned utility, you have shareholders, having certainty around approval of a contract in its terms is of value to that, for investor-owned entity. And I'll just stop there. I see John's on the screen. And, I know that it was not a state requirement when I started historically, as the history was told to me 20 years ago, that it was something the utility wanted to do. And then when the electrics and the rail belt started to purchase their own fuel, that practice just continued. And as far as we know, it is technically a requirement today to get a fuel contract approved by the commission.
Thank you. Mr. Rivita?
Hey, is it
Hold on, John's hand up. I'm sorry.
I was just a quick comment. So the commission has the power to reject our gas cost adjustment, which is what Tony's referring to there, and that is a look back at gas that's already been sold to customers and adjusted going forward in some instances. And so from the vendor-owned utility, that's massive risk of having any of those costs disallowed, which is why the preference to get the gas contract approved prior to them being seen in the gas cost adjustment is important to us.
Appreciate that. And any feedback analysis you have on the actual cost that regulatory requirements have on your utility or your customer base, really good to for the committee to have. So the purpose is we're looking for a streamlining is to lower the cost. And if it's just an annoyance, well, then we'll have an annoyance for the day. So there's an actual cost that we need to put into context and see how we can address that. That kind of information would be helpful to the committee.
For the record, I'm not sure, but I'm being close to it. I'm going to speculate. I think with some high probability that what's being talked about here in retrospect was a massive issue. It cost a utility millions of dollars to adjudicate, to seek approval, and then to have rejection in the latter part of that first decade of this century. It led to a period where we went from the ability to obtain 20-year supplies to 1-year supplies to sometimes it being rejected outright. So I can think of a worst case in which I believe it's cost over $1 billion because producers said if this is rejected, we're leaving the state, and they left the state. They said state's closed for business. Long before Commissioner Kerber, before this, the makeup of the current commission. I think what I'm seeing here is probably a recommendation that if there's a way to streamline, without taking out the benefit for investor-owned utilities, which I absolutely believe it is significant, maybe to streamline fuel supply agreements so that it's not similar to a rate case, there would be some benefit in terms of savings to ratepayers.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know most of this, this is not initial, I know most of the discussion is on gas contracts, but the word IPP slipped in here, and I think it goes back to some of the risks where we're trying to lower costs. And IPPs also need the certainty, and they need the arbitrator to approve where somebody says, no, this is unreasonable, and IPC says, no, this is a reasonable rate. Then who plays the jump ball and decides? I think there's a role in that dilemma. I like Tony's suggestion, though, is that if we could streamline that certainty for both parties and we could come to a yes-no conclusion faster rather than a full-blown rate case, I think that benefits all parties to lower the cost of power. But I'm just throwing in the IPP aspect here because a small solar developer or whatnot wants to have their risk reduced as well, that they have a contract at the end of the rainbow that they've done all the effort. So anyway, I just throw that in perspective out. Thank you.
Right. Just for co-chair Venables, Keith Kerber, yeah, I can just underscore what Tony just said because some of those stories were told to me when I first arrived, but again, it was by people just doing that as things they heard as upon their coming on the commission. So if those things are still there and there's a concern, which it could be bubbling up, especially with the situation of Cook Inlet natural gas, I don't know if that's something that's sort of lurking in the back of people's minds that we would be, getting back into that and then just sitting on it. Like I said, I'll just have to go back and do a little bit of research on this. But from a historical perspective, everything Tony said has been echoed by peers of mine as part of the lore of the commission before it even got there, right? I mean, this was actually right about the time our longest serving people came aboard in like 2008, that time frame. So I really do think this is something to take a look at. If I get the email, then I can, take this back and with specificity give my tasks to my staff to give us some thoughts on that, okay?
All right, thank you. And we will pass this round to the subcommittee, which just came in time. I appreciate them rushing this for consideration today. Mr. Reno, if you want to get a couple other paragraphs to close out before we get to the real meaty stuff at the beginning, please proceed.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. Michael Rapido, Alaska Power Association. The next one from the bottom, going from the bottom up, is duplicative election requirements. And this is something that I hadn't thought about, but statute AS 1025-120 prohibit the utility from implementing online-only elections. And as our members of cooperatives have moved into a kind of a high-tech way to vote, I mean, I know my, I vote through my SmartHub app for my own utility NDA. There's been kind of a move to move this online, and there's many different ways to vote online. And so some of the feedback was the amount of time and effort and materials it takes to also do a kind of print, old school, so to speak, election when an electronic election could be implemented. I don't think it's the hugest cost on Earth, but it was something that was flagged for us from a member or two, so we decided to put it in here. So that's the summary of that one.
All right, thank you. And is that statutory? Who has the authority to change that?
Well, if it's dealing with utility elections, then I think it's probably us.
Okay.
We can certainly take a look at that. Like I said, getting an email would be good. But these types of things, I think, have become even more important post the pandemic, because so many things went online then, and whereas before in the past, you know, I can remember going out, hey, show up for your AMA, do your vote, all those things like that. So anyway, I think that's something to be worked on. Again, Keith Kerber for the record.
Any other comments on this section here?
Well, if it, I'll only add, this is Nancy, if it's a statute change, the legislature has to.
That is definitely the voice of veterans' authority on the subject. So
right, that's the difference. Statutes are law, regulations are what we do, based on the statutes that get done. So anyway, that's just
good. All right,
good so, follow-up by the lieutenant governor who was indeed a legislator. So thank you for that.
There's no higher authority on that topic. Okay. Next, Mr. Rito.
Thanks. Yes, Alaska Power Association for the record. Next one up, above the, do you want me to go from the top of the section or just keep going from the bottom up?
You know, maybe you give us a quick summary on the land management, and then we'll move on to the regulatory.
So, and again, I want to make sure I preface this with knowing that this was done pretty, we put this together fairly quickly, which doesn't mean that it's a bad product. It just means it's a product where we collected the feedback and put it into the document in time to get it for this community hearing. And so any ambiguity or outdatedness or anything like that, I think we'll apologize for at the forefront, and then we can pick through these as we go. But these are experiences or observations from member electric utilities in our membership. So this land management title deals with a little bit of the Alaska Railroad Corporation permitting, and I'm not an expert on this, but I'll just summarize what we've heard from members. And a lot of this deals with the cost of doing business and crossing tracks and other activities along those lines. I don't know what's fair in this from my own standpoint of what's a fair charge between the Alaska Railroad Corporation and electric utility. That might be a better question for an electric utility that has multiple crossings on the railroad. But this was something, the cost of these permitting fees and these requirements was flagged as something that was obviously passed on to ratepayers, and that I think a portion of our membership at least feels could be lower or streamlined in a way that makes a lot easier. And they even, this was not an ETA solution, this was a solution suggested by a member to look to a South Dakota railroad permitting process that they seem to feel was a lot more tenable. And if you see there's a one-time fee of $750 of safety specifications that have been met, again, this is not my area of expertise, but just laying that out for that session.
So this, just John Zinser, chiming in real quick, this is a big issue for NSTAR and has been for decades. We've had significant battles with the railroad on their permitting fees, and this is also something that's going, I think it's the Alaska Supreme Court, as they're in a litigation with the subdivision of South Anchorage. So this is to be continued on what they can actually charge. But it is a major cost. A lot of people like to say they're not a railroad, they're a real estate company. And one of their major sources of revenue for them. So it's a massive issue for utilities.
Thank you. Moving on.
Okay, thank you. Michael Rosito again, Alaska Power Association. The next in that land management section was the DOT permit for crossing, I think, the DOT-managed road. And what the feedback on this from our membership was, this is in the case where it's, as I understand it, not poles or anchors, but simply a wire crossing a DOT-managed road, and the permit fees being unreasonably high, according to the feedback we received. And there, our membership had suggested that if there is a simple road crossing where no poles or anchors are actually in the right-of-way, simply a wire strung across the road, but no other sort of anchors into the road, that there should be a simple notification process so that everyone is sure that the process is being done safely, and so that there's no, you know, danger to drivers or other folks, but that there shouldn't be a permitting fee or any sort of other requirements on that that might cost a significant amount of money.
Yeah. Yes, actually, did you make a comment on the DNR as well? I think we've talked about the roads right away. As well, but is there any particular insight on DNR that you wanted to mention? It's right below that section on the screen there.
Could you help this, Jim, if you want me to keep going?
Yes, please.
Michael Rugido, the next one is, we've already talked about just a minute ago about the DOT right-of-way issue, so I won't go on that one again. And then going up the top section, Mr. Chairman, at the risk of seemingly like I'm gonna like topping out, I actually would rather not address each of these point by point because I do not live in the regulatory realm. That's not my forte, so to speak. This is feedback that we receive from our members who do live in the regulatory realm. And so I would be completely unprepared to address each of these one by one myself, but it's something that we receive from folks in our membership who do deal with regulations on a daily basis, and this is the suggestions that they put forth. I agree with that.
And we can, because we will take that information. We could just start at the top of the letter there that that section says regulatory affairs, and just slowly scroll down, just for context, not for reading purposes, but just for context for the committee. And then we'll go ahead and we'll segue over to Chairman Kerber just for some general remarks about the regulatory. We'll just keep scrolling down as you would say. There's about a dozen different examples of some of the regulatory issues that utilities readily identify as having an impact. And so we'll queue this up for more specific conversations at the next meeting, but I wanted to at least change gears and go into the regulatory conversations. But are there any questions from the subcommittee for Mr. Rovito or Alaska Power Association before we move on? One thing that I was curious about, I'd love to have context. If any utilities want to share, you know, what kind of fiscal impact that this has. Sometimes for whole few acres, they see this list and yes, there's sympathies, but not, you know, sometimes the cost for compliance is equal to or more than sometimes the amount of co-op has less than the bank at the end of the year. So, you know, it can be substantial in some cases, but
I'll look, this is Keith Kerr for the record. We'll take a look at this information and see what we can do. I mean, what we know can help us and get better, right? So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right. So, Ms. Rito, any final comments before we move on from this? And again, we really appreciate the Alaska Power Association and utility members for the responsiveness and participation in our meetings.
This is Michael Rovito again. No further comments, just to say thanks to all of you on the subcommittee and the full task force for the work you put into this. And we're engaged and happy to answer any questions. And if there's anything in this that you see that I wasn't able to address that you need to follow up on, I'm happy to go run down to answer the questions that I don't know. So thanks again.
All right. Thank you. So So one of the things that we discussed at our subcommittee meeting just last, was it Friday? We've had one business day since then, so it's pretty amazing to get some, as much feedback as we have.
I just want to say I appreciate the specificity of your recommendations, and doesn't mean they're all need to be accepted, but they definitely need to be evaluated.
And that's we'll get this distributed to the committee, the task force, and then we'll keep that up for discussion at the next meeting for any further input or questions. So. So one of the things that we had discussed with Chairman Kerber about the RSCA is trying to get a handle on the volume of compliance measures. And Mr. Kerber, do you have a response show and tell that you can?
No, I don't have a show and tell. I don't have a PowerPoint. In respect to your response, you...
Put your parts of the notebook.
Oh, right. I guess I can do it. I did it online. It wasn't nearly as powerful as being able to pick it up. And I'll not throw it at anybody, especially the Lieutenant Governor, because I want to stay alive today, okay? But
exactly.
Yeah, but anyway, it's, there's writing on both sides of the pages. But I don't think when you talk about an agency... Knowing what I know about government, what's sitting in the law library at the RCA, this isn't all that much. But it is based on the laws, the Alaska statutes, which it's possible that there are people in this room, and of course people listening online, I think for our community, we have Senator Cliff Bishop and Representative Rauscher, and I don't know if the principals have been at these meetings because I heard the legislative aides or assistants signing in, but the point is that These aren't done willy-nilly. There's a tremendous process that goes into that, and we are part of that process in respect to producing bill analysis and fiscal notes that can aid the legislature in making hopefully a better policy position. We aren't the people who are going to make the votes. We're not going to do that. But we are often called before committees to testify on proposed legislation and even potentially offer opinions. And so... shortly before coming on the commission, I was linked up with the former commissioner. I wasn't seated at that time, and I cleared it with then Chair Pickett, and it was really just a sort of a Proverbs discussion, so to speak, on he amassed about 8 Proverbs to being a regulatory commissioner. I've added one for myself. It's like my number one. It's a description of my personal regulatory philosophy, which is he regulates best, he regulates least. So when we get a recommendation from industry, say, hey, look, this is outdated. When I was in general in January, I was sitting across from Commissioner Standy, Deputy Commissioner Caleb Fowler, and they were talking about a statute that they had that allowed people to pay via telegraph. Well, I don't know how many people have been using telegraph lately, but it's things like that, that if we get something that might have made sense 20 or 30 years ago, then we'll definitely take a look at it. Because, hey, reducing the size of this binder would be okay. Right? So I hope that gives you a sense to both the co-chairs that one, I concur with what Coach Hammond said about the specificity. It's really good when you're given a laundry list, a to-do list. Even if it has 20 things on it, just as slow as you're scrolling through those, they're kind of disparate. They're not like a whole chunk from one thing. They're little bits and pieces from the whole lineup. I see my colleague, Chris Stanheim, who's the co-chair of the whole task force. And because he and I are joining the HIP in the PCE program, it's important. He sees these things too, because if they do affect PC, then that's going to affect both of us and how we work and operate. So the bottom, for me, being on the task force, these are the kinds of things when they said, hey, you're on the regulation statutes, that's where I need to be. So we'll do what we can. And, when we finish out the meeting today and we know what our next deals are, at least that'll give me my time frame to be able to produce something on these for you all. So that'll be my plan.
Okay. A couple of things, just for the record, we had asked that at our next one of the next meetings to get a list of current proposed legislation. Some legislators maybe haven't filed yet, but have something in working form. So we'll get that for discussion here in the next meeting or so. But I'm just curious if the commission has received input that has value for the committee that identifies fiscal impacts of maybe complaints that have come about particular administrative code or enforcement or statutes or
No, I'm not aware of anything that's been coming in by way of public comment at this point, because typically legislation is entered into the session, the bill is introduced, then it's heard, and then usually when it's heard is when we have our clock, which is a very short clock, often like a Wednesday to a Friday, to give our bill announcement fiscal vote. We did receive a bill at the end of last session, SB 152, it's called Community Energy, and it's essentially like, you know, trying to get people to pool assets to buy a solar unit, to aid in a like a community building, right? And you could buy a share in that and receive some of the benefits as if you were net metering yourself. And we just got it. We're actually pretty grateful because one of the things that I'm working on is I want to make our process to receive those bills, process them, produce bill analysis, fiscal notes in a way that I think is, you know, at a high level, and then, you know, distribute them so that what we give back to the legislature for their, because there's a section on there where it says, you know, do you support, do you oppose, are you neutral? We can't do that without talking about that in a public meeting format. So currently right now, I think you may have heard this in some conversations, but the two RPS bills, one from the House, one from the Senate, exactly the same. We're just having conversations in our public meetings just to get, you know, data points out in the public record for these particular bills. And, you know, the possibility exists that we could go through that and still say we're going to be neutral on this, because it's important for the state to understand, especially if there's, you know, it was mentioned about permitting, and that was a big part of some of the conversation with Mr. Rubio, but we really don't permit, we certificate. The process of providing an entity a certificate of public convenience and necessity, a CPCN, is essentially their license, their power to actually do their business, okay? And permitting, I think that falls into the DOT and some of these other areas that have already been discussed. So that it's a small term, but it actually is a pretty large term for us. And as far as us being enforcers with sort of police-like powers, we don't really do that, right? I mean, we have the ability to address practices, management practices within a utility, but that's a high level, and it's not fun to get involved in those, right? And we do have some penalty things we can impose on people. For the most part, that's not normally our position. And I know in some of the bills we did put in notes that suggest that we're going to need more personnel to be able to do that sort of oversight function. So I don't know if that gives you some background for us, but I think oftentimes when people think about regulators, they think about folks that are going to come up to their job site and shut them down. And that's not, you know, we don't have the personnel to do stuff like that.
Absent legislative action and reform, what internal processes does the commission embrace, and is there such reviews underway now that would perhaps be streamlining anyway?
Well, as I think I mentioned this last meeting, but I have one of our more senior people who's kind of coming to the conclusion of his career, and he has a task to go and do that indexing of our statutes and regulations so that we can have easy access, especially if we get things like this from the industry where we say, hey, we're seeing this, we feel like this is a problem, perhaps it's outdated, could you take a look at it, right? And this is actually probably the first forum that I've been in where we've actually received things with this specificity. So, you know, if you don't know, you can't do anything, but now we have some things we can go work on that, okay?
And his retirement date is?
He's got more than a year.
Mr. Kutcher, do you have a comment?
Well, I do have a comment on the PCE program at some point when it kind of fits in as appropriate.
Any other questions about the commission's role here and further information we want to get?
Okay. He's all on him. And because Commissioner Thurber and Sebi was kind of throwing the hip on PCE, I thought it might be timely. But first of all, I really believe in kind of the statewide objectives of this task force of looking not just at the railroad, but how to, you know, move cost savings into rural Alaska. And I believe that the PCE program is a key component of that. So listening to the Rural Alaska Energy presentations that were part of the symposium that, you know, was the task force organized, I was struck by two or three comments that I was really concerned about. And that was that some folks mentioned that when they had instituted renewables in their community and it resulted in lower cost energy in those communities, that it resulted in a reduction in the PC payments, and that they were viewing those PC payments kind of as an entitlement rather than kind of what I thought the objective should be, is to pay them to kind of balance out the cost of power statewide. And so it was mentioned a couple times that seeing their way through that was to develop these power generation projects as IPPs and sell that power to AVEC, which then, you know, AVEC one gets reimbursed, you know, for the PCE, and completely neutering out the objective of all of us trying to reduce our power costs. That's something that I think needs to be taken a hard look at in terms of the structure of the what's approved in terms of you know, the way power is generated, processed, and sold in all of Alaska, including rural Alaska, because they're essentially trying to subvert the objectives of lowering the cost of power. I know it's a hard topic, but I think we ought to be transparent and realize we're all in it together, and it's, PC is not a specific, you know, entitlement program. It's relates to reflection of cost of power.
Well,
so
Chief, for the record, all I can say is, I mean, you know, I know that this has come up with conversations with Curtis and I. As the goal, I think, of the PC program is to help all of us have a reasonable cost of energy, right? And so that fund is used to sort of help the folks who are paying a super high level energy get down to where there's an equivalency with the railroad, right? Because it's based on the Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau triangle, so to speak. And then I just noticed anecdotally from talking to Curtis that individuals that receive, or communities that receive grants, not loans, but grants, to get certain kinds of energy in there to do that, to bring their cost of energy down, and they're wondering why they're still not getting a PC. And I think that's actually cooked into statute. So, Chris, do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, on a couple points with CCE, and that is this, you know, we're bound, AEA as well as RCA is bound by statute. And PCE was literally created almost 40 years ago. And the whole idea of it was that they do pay rural Alaska, at least at that time, was 750 kilowatts in order to 500 ounces of 750 kilowatts, for residential consumers to pay the same as the railroad. So they pay 20 cents, and the state, through the PCE, will pay that difference up to a dollar. And what was never, I think, was an unintended consequence was renewables. Nobody had considered the renewable component on a large scale. You know, the state has supported through the Renewable Energy Fund well over $300 million, as well as other direct appropriations that to help communities in Alaska go renewable, but as their price drop below the floor, that 20 cent average floor, they're not eligible for PCE. And so I agree, you know, I understand where you're coming from, and that's the question, I think. And the legislature, by the way, has been reluctant to address it. Because one of the concerns is if you open up PCE, you open up that title, and behind that title is a $1 billion endowment that opens that potential up. And so I think that's a concern that is really more, if there needs to be changes to PCE, it has to be statutorily. And if somebody is wanting to do something different, then maybe it's outside of PCE and how you address lowering the cost of pushing more people towards renewable, and we've done that through the Renewable Energy Fund. So it's kind of a mix. We have one community in rural Alaska that received $3.8 million in grants. They believe they're behind, that we also owe them $2 million in PCE. well, if we were paying CC, we would have probably never done the 3.8 because it was kind of a way a handoff to go renewable. But again, I think it's important that if communities do step forward, kind of look to see what a solution is to get them on renewables, rather than, like you said, you know, gaming the system by going an ICP route, which is not the intent of the PC program, and eventually drains that program from other communities that are harder. You know, some communities are blessed to be right next to a river or a biomass or solar. They have, some of the communities in Alaska are really challenged to go renewable. And so we just need to find that mix. But I don't necessarily know if the opening up the PCE is the right fix for it. It's probably something similar, or to see if there's something we already have that we can modify, the Renewable Energy Fund or another opportunity like that, Power Project Fund or something like that to fund those activities. But we have their concerns, but again, we have to follow the statute. So.
And then also there's a piece too where we can't just, okay, we do the accounting, so to speak, and then HERS and AEA writes the checks. We can't make a disbursement unless we get a report. And in some cases, we don't get reports from people, and if you don't file your report, we can't do the paperwork to get you the thing. So it's kind of like, well, we're not getting a PC. Did you file a report? No, you didn't file a report. Why didn't you file a report? Because if you file a report, we say you didn't get a PC. You know, I mean, it's kind of one of those, you know, like this type of deals, a circular race. But, you know, anyway, it's, I think the goal is to get people having cheaper energy. That's, I think that's been the aspirational goal, and I see Jen nodding her head. And in her area, she's working at that. People around here, we're all kind of focused, and I think this morning we all got a little shot of energy that there could be some future things that we do, or some policy directions we recommend. We're not going to be the ones pulling the trigger on those policy decisions, but we're putting them out there so that there could be a vision for the state to get to that 10% or even potentially lower energy. So to the extent that we, the regulatory commission, can address these issues, we'll do our best to provide feedback, but also that in the sheet here that we're developing, hopefully those, some of them may be, hey, no brainer. We should think about this one. Because again, it's a regulation, it came from statute. Okay?
Yeah. One point, I think it's important to note is if we lower the cost, because the PCE endowment is tied to the cost of all the rail belt, Fairbanks, and of course we throw in general as a weighted average general. But when you look at that, if we can lower the cost on the rail belt, it's a direct benefit to the PCE program, because for every penny you draw on the rail belt is $1.7 million available to the PCE because it draws it, so what they get from Alaska is a greater amount. So if we do get to 10-cent power, there's another $17 million in PCE just for rural Alaska component of it. So there is an incentive for the rail belt to go down for many reasons, but it also lifts up rural Alaska in the sense of the PCE endowment.
There is, I think, so just to jump in and add a little bit, I believe it was you, Co-Chair Venables, who explained and said if we can fix the rail belt, we're going to help fix everybody, right? Number one. But number two, let's not forget, I believe it was Mr. Andrew Guy that mentioned that, of course, the community buildings and the stores and things like that do not receive PC, so he didn't see it as a long-term fix. I think his perspective on getting businesses out there, like mines or other things like that, and you know that there's great potential for that, especially rare earth minerals up north, you know, and he has a particular mind in his area that they're looking at. Those kinds of things can provide the thing which can help people where, you know, they start getting the capital available to engage the IPPs or the other entities who want to provide energy infrastructure that can all already help them lower the cost of energy in their area. Does that help?
Okay. Yeah, that's good. I think we just have to keep thinking big picture. And not that one region there is just often seen as PC being a subsidy for those people over there, or those people over there see things like the last genocide being owned by the public, or, you know, subsidies going for cooking with natural gas. But we make investments in our people for the state, and so we're looking for statewide solutions. So we'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, this is crucial. You know, one thing I think is important to note, and that is where PCE is about $40 million a year, the state ownership of the Northern Intertie from Anchorage to Fairbanks saves the Fairbanks economy over $40 million a year because they can buy economy energy sales here on the rail belt cheaper and ship it to Fairbanks than they can produce it on their own. So that's one thing when people are critical of a subsidy for rural Alaska, the first thing I point out to is the state investment in that infrastructure takes, you know, just an example on Fairbanks, and those are Fairbanks, that's going to Valley numbers, not our mountain, those are going to Valley numbers. And so the state has made investments, they've done a PCE endowment in rural Alaska, and they've invested in infrastructure in urban Alaska. And so there has been a balance, but at the end of the day, we both have benefited, urban as well as it has benefited from the state investment. Yeah.
Thanks. And while we're talking about funds, well, hold that thought. This is special. Do you want to say something?
No, I want to follow up PCE. This is on PCE related topic. You know, I don't know on PC what the requirements are for the utility to have life cycle management, to do the maintenance, to ensure that the things are operated. You know, I know some have a hard time filling out the paperwork and getting the monies in. But for paying these things, having control of your assets, having control of your costs, is an important public asset and a public interest value so that those investments are being made, one, properly with taxpayer dollars, but secondly, it helps identify where you're weak. It helps identify where you need to have additional help or where you can more operate efficiently. So rather than take away PC or FIP, how do we maybe incorporate some suggestions of making it better or making it more efficient so that, you know, I just throw out those competencies or those efficiencies, operating efficiencies that could be helping, because if you have a utility that isn't doing that and they're doing it and you have one that is, you know, they're very worthy and they're taking that responsibility greatly, and we just want to make sure that that level of standardization might be something of interest in the PCE, because it will ultimately save money, which then furthers the fund, but also opens up opportunities, whether you're going to add a business or a community building. So it's very much related. I just put that for a comment.
Thank you. At the last meeting, we also touched about, emerging technology funds, and maybe you said there's people that were not part of that meeting. You could just speak to that.
Yeah, there was a white paper that we'll make sure gets circulated by EEA. There was a fund called the Emergency Energy Technology Fund. It was established by the 26th Alaska Legislature, and it was to promote the expansion of energy sources available to Alaskans through, and it was passed unanimously. And what it was is to look at emerging technologies. Well, when this was established literally 8-10 years ago, a lot of the emerging technologies back then are actual real technologies today. But also, when the state was running out of money and it did not have a lot of funds, the legislature, this just naturally sunsetted and it was never restarted. And so what we had done is looking at the fund establishment, kind of looking at how it was administered. You had to have a board of seven with specific, engineers and technicians to look at it. And so one of the concepts is for the committee to look at restarting the Emergency Energy Technology Fund, which requires statutory change, and includes statutes, but it's already all there. It was just, we let it last because we didn't have money, and now we have these technologies, and Department of Energy, it would be really helpful if we had this program back, because it was just, we're just in a unique time right now. We're even federal projects. We can't, and we've heard it before, where we're having trouble managing federal dollars. And so this would kind of give that opportunity for that. And so what would be circulated for everybody, just future consideration, is the white paper, but also all the projects that funded. And this was a partnership with ASAP, who helped provide the technical assistance. So it was a well laid out program. It was just, it ran out of money and it died for no good reason other than, like all good projects with the state, you run out of money, we just let it die. But now is the time to maybe relook at it and reestablish it, because it's what we're talking about now, is all these new technologies and how we can incorporate it, especially in rural Alaska.
So the committee will get that letter, and we can discuss that more. It's on the screen now, but wouldn't put that picture that gets put on the action item list to reinvigorate, restore, resurrect, and then we can go from there. One question I had relating to regulatory, which we discussed a little bit at the previous meeting, but how do we compare with other states? How do we know where maybe this is a streamlined version, every other state has four of those notebooks, so, or the other states have just a, you know, this size, you know, how do we ground truth that? Where do we go for that kind of information?
I appreciate you bringing that up. There's a couple of things I was thinking about. It was brought up last meeting. Michael, I need to make sure I get your email before we leave today because I couldn't find it on the SharePoint. And so I want to make sure that, because I think this is just brought up by when sitting in with the railroad this morning, Jen had her, PowerPoint and like, what are our jobs, what are our tasks, et cetera. So with respect to, the comparison piece, I think that'd be something to pass to the, some of our contractor help, I would hope. And I would just recommend that maybe we take a look at some states that sort of mirror us. Now, serendipitously, this morning, the rail belt took a look at a country called Iceland, which has some similarities to us, but then has some things that are divergent, like it's an island in the middle of the Atlantic or on the Pacific side, but populations not necessarily perfectly aligned. But we got some things out of that might be useful in terms of targeting potential questions of action for the task force at large. So if I was going to pick just a few places, especially because of the nature of the state itself, I might look at Wyoming. Yes, they're smaller than us, but they're also an energy-rich state that is kind of suffering right now due to the energy transition. I might look at North Dakota because they're an energy-rich state that is kind of going through transition as well with the larger energy transition. And ones that are a little bit more apples to apples instead of oranges to oranges. I'm less concerned of whether or not they have 3 commissioners, 5 commissioners, 7 commissioners, 9 commissioners. That isn't the biggest thing. It's like they're like us. They have been very sort of productive for the United States of America in providing energy in a macro sense. It's not, it's a utility scale, but they compare us in a lot of other ways, you know, distributed populations, small populations. Of course, they've got interconnection capabilities in the world for you that we'll never have. So that's the part where if we're going to pick a few states, I would say, hey, give some direction to our Michael Baker or our Black and East people to just maybe do a survey of a few of those states that could be similar to us, especially in the energy transition piece. That's my opinion based on my time on the commission, if that helps. Does that help at all?
It helps you. Let's try to segue right back to where I wanted to end up on as we wrap up the meeting up today to let you respond to the fact that Michael Baker has that kind of long arms to reach around the country to bring us perhaps some information.
We do have offices all around the country, and we're happy to kind of do that industry scan. So.
And then
The other thing, this is Nancy, we can take advantage of National Conference of State Legislators or the National Lieutenant Governors Association and ask those questions. That information is already cataloged. We don't have to research, though.
Right, and I would say, and this is key for NERC, our National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, and the NASIO, which is, I think, the National State Energy Office, which is what Chris is both. I got to meet one of his wonderful colleagues, Audrey, when I was at the nuclear training, and it was very important that most of the states sent, you know, both the regulators and the State Energy Office people to those situations. I'm going to throw this out. I'm going to take a risk here, Co-Chair Venables, with your permission. That's that we did hear a little bit about an interesting setup with respect to Iceland, where they had their commission and their energy office kind of together. If there was, I don't know that there is, right? Because again, it's not just 50 states; it's the territories that also have their utility commissions and their energy offices. But maybe to see if there's some states around the United States that have a closer connection I mean, I don't know that every state has something like a PCE that would connect the energy offices like the RCA and AEA are. But it might be interesting to take a look at that, just in the sense of, it felt this morning like we really were starting to do some brainstorming here. I mean, not just it's a subcommittee thing that Coach Hand and I sat in on, but also just in a larger sense, you know, I mean, it's kind of dispiriting when you get a task that looks pretty much impossible. But, you know, if you break it into smaller bites, maybe we can get there. So that's just something I've gone to, and I'm willing to work with Michael, you know, whatever, once I get his email, you know, we can talk through the scope and scale of it, so we're not asking for the moon. We get something that's actionable in a short period of time, because I do feel a lot of pressure in November. Someone said October. I hope it's still November. Do we have till November? Is that
November?
Thank you, Lord. Okay, so we can go to Thanksgiving happy, right?
There you go. Well, and good behavior. You get out earlier. You know, the three things that I would like to have at the next meeting is the overview and maybe a presentation by Michael Baker on what does the state do and how they got to that point and what the justification was. I'd also like to see a response from the letter that's about the Fire Association.
You're going to get that
if you just don't know it. But if you could be prepared for that, and then asking the asking the authority to work with legal or whoever has the list of proposed or pending legislation that might be a vehicle to enhance some of these things.
Right. One thing I will say, I've been in state government a couple of contracts, 10 years, but my first day was working with the RCA at the Commerce Committee and Economic Development as the Deputy Commissioner. And I will say one thing, it was back then and it holds true today, we collectively need to figure out what resources we need to give the RCA to do their job. And Commissioner Cooper is a great advocate for the RCA, but we need to kind of peel that onion back because there's staffing issues. They need engineers, they need attorneys, they need to pay them competitive wages, which is a little bit outside the pay, the MA, or they're restricted to the state pay scale. So we've got to look to see what does that look like and not put Commissioner Kerber in an awkward position advocating for that as the lead agency. But for us, because there's a lot of examples around the country and there's a lot of information we can point to make sure that the Regulatory Commission has the resources to do the job that they have to do. And in my opinion, they've been shortchanged for the last 15 years. And it's nobody's fault. It's nobody's pointing a finger at it. It's evolved into it, and they've been stuck staff-wise and financially and being able to compensate people in the past, not looking at the reality of today. How many engineers are you looking for, and how many attorneys would you like to have on board?
Well, we're going to be down one attorney here shortly, and we just had an interview. We had one applicant, and that didn't work out. So it's just, I think, to be fair, though, I don't feel unique in the staffing issues, but I certainly appreciate the words of my colleague, Chris, there, because you can't offer value added if you don't have the assets to do it. And especially with the RRC standing up, having a power systems engineer, utility, and master items would be really good. But I wouldn't feel safe hiring them right now because I want to be able to pay them. And that has to do with something called a statutory gap, because I don't get a general fund appropriation. I have to go earn my money. And it's, as Tony has mentioned this a couple times, it's kind of the way the regulatory compact is set up, and it's called cause or cause payer. If NEA does a filing, we're on the clock for NEA, and that's connected to electric utilities. If AWU does a filing, we're on the clock. That's a water utility, and all the different sectors get sort of worked out via a very not complex calculus math problem, but based so that it's spread across the totality of the utilities that we regulate. So thank you for those kind words. I'll take any help we can get, but some of it is, I think we're all going to have to look at that, even though it's not necessarily a remit straight to the utility issue or the energy issue, but we got to have people to do it. When Tony said recently something effective, well, I could get rid of my entire staff, and that would save 0.7 cents or something like that, but of course then you wouldn't have a very well-running utility. Yeah, so that's some of the challenges you're facing. So thank you for those words, Curtis, and I've got a proposal forward, but did you want me to bring that one or just the ones that, you know, just so you're aware of it?
Bring what you can, and Michael Baker will, make his coordinate and make sure that we're not asking two people to do the same task. So we're going to do a wrap, so quick comments from committee and co-chair.
So, I wanted to refer to co-chair. Tony is up to the record. Yeah, perfect. My comment or question, comment was going to be really a wrap-up comment, and that is, I really appreciate the discussion. I'll share a little bit of a concern that I have that we get too far into the weeds when I think we should be at an altitude where we're looking at the regulatory commission, for example, or any legislation that's needed, or other state agencies, whatever it might be, in terms of what is it that, you know, we want them to be, and then what is it that they need so that they can be that. And I'm less concerned about a list of, you know, minor statutory things that we can work through on our own. I think we probably all agree, you know, we could do poll, for example, you know, do we want a regulatory commissioner or do we not? I know people, counterparts, would rather not be regulated at all. My own opinion is, I think it's a necessary balance. It's part of that regulatory compact for having a monopoly. And coming from the investor-owned world, there's certainty. You throw in question whether there's going to be a regulatory body, and your shareholders are off the ledge with concern about the uncertainty to get things approved or a covered call. So I'm one that's in support, but I'm in support of a high-functioning entity that can move through the process quickly, not be dysfunctional, not stop necessary progress, be educated on what's coming so that they can facilitate, and being willing to change and try new things. I mean, there are different rate designs that are going to be needed for the future that we all can see in some form or fashion. I want to be able to facilitate your ability to do that. And so I would rather be at that level of discussion than maybe, you know, the list of, you know, specific statutes or things
like that. No, thank you for that clarification. I'm not looking for the community to weigh in on the merits of those individual concerns. I'm looking for characterization of these are the types of issues that the utilities are bringing forward, and they're there because they need statutory change, or they need, how do we structure the response? And so that's kind of what I'm looking for in response to the APA letter. It's not, well, the third bullet is, I don't want to get into W comment. I just look structurally, what kind of impacts do we have so that we can adjust how to streamline those. So.
Okay, and Trevor, for the record, appreciate that kind of clarification, guys, because as I camp with Michael after this, we'll want to know, like, hey, we want to come with the right product. Thank you.
The final word, Mr. Co-Chair.
No further comment.
Because you're going to be the most favorite co-chair, so, okay. Anything from, we get 5 minutes back, we're 5 minutes ahead of schedule, so we now get a 15-minute break instead of a 10-minute break.
15-minute break, and there is fresh coffee.
Could it be 8 o'clock?